The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. I am here with Murray Barlow going back to South Africa for my final wine interview, the cellar master at Rustenburg Estate. Murray, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Matthew, lovely to be with you and to be talking to you after having you on the estate a few months ago.
It feels like forever, and it feels like we just left yesterday. You know what? Let's start here. How are things in the wine industry in Stellenbosch, where you are now versus when I was there, when it was the beginning of Omicron?
Sure. So we, you know, obviously the Omicron variant of COVID was discovered in South Africa. It's not a South African variant, but we discovered it, and then the whole world said to us that we had put us in the naughty corner, really.
Yes.
So we lost all the tourism that was meant to, you know, our high tourist season, December, January, February, March. It's our lovely, it's a warm season for us. So people are escaping the Northern Hemisphere winter. And we lost all that tourist season. So that was a bit of a blow. But we were in the process of opening up already. And things have really improved considerably. You know, we had during our lockdowns a lot of prohibition where we weren't allowed to sell locally. And that's all fallen away. And it really feels like we're back to normal. We've had some fantastic harvests of late. And things are really looking up. I'm quite bullish. This vintage was good. And, you know, we're seeing the balance coming back into the supply and demand in the wine industry in general. So things are really moving forward and going back to a state of normal. I mean, we all have challenges now, I think, beyond COVID time. Our big challenge now is inflation. I'm sure everyone's sick to death about hearing about it, but we use a lot of inputs from the grape to the glass. You know, there's a huge amount that's influenced by the fuel price and all the different commodities going up. So wine, unfortunately, globally is going to be getting more expensive. It's just the reality of all farming. And you know, we add so much value to the product that we are going to see inflation. So that's my big challenge now. So it never ends. If it's not the weather or the government, it's inflation. So we just keep on our toes, and it's how it's been for hundreds of years. And that's farming. That's what we have to do.
We'll get to inflation in a second. And it, you know, it's funny. It's a global thing. It's not one pocket of the world. But if we can go back to a year or so, or less than a year, those prohibition days, those Al Capone days in Stellenbosch and in Cape Town, what were those days like for you, for friends of yours in the industry, for other wineries?
Well, we're fortunate we export most of our production, just over 90%. So for us, it wasn't that big a blow. I can tell you, having as someone who has a private wine setup where I keep and age my own wines, I suddenly had a lot more friends. I had access to lots of wine. And there were people who were sort of prohibition busting. So you could go to restaurants or certain restaurants and wink at the waiter and order a pot of, you could order a pot of white tea or a pot of red tea, and they bring a teapot to you with
really
white or red wine. And that did happen. And there were also instances where, you know, people, you know, wine, people who had wine and wine stores were selling out the back door at sort of mini multiples of what the wines would normally cost, you know, to the extent that when those prohibitions were over, or they were temporarily over, and those stores were empty. So the sales were fantastic because everyone needed to restock. So it was a strange sort of stop-start time. I think we were all dealing with so much, and it just added a bit to the intrigue and the sort of the nonsense we had to deal with during that time. So
I love the idea of white tea versus red tea. And then it's like, well, we feel like more of an acidic, fresh white tea versus a more full-bodied, slightly oak-influenced white tea.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, don't tell South Africans what to do. We'll get our own way.
Yeah,
stubborn like that. So there was always a will. There's always a way there.
It was funny, like when we were there stuck, and we got home relatively quickly considering. The one thing I remembered is that, like, in South Africa, in Cape Town, you guys had far harder rules than we had here in Toronto and Ontario and Canada. And I saw so many more people wearing masks outdoors and where you guys were than where we were. Let's go to inflation, and then we'll get into the fun stuff, your own journey and things like that. But just the global factors, and this is for people listening who maybe get upset, like, well, why is my wine was always $17.95? Why is it now $21.95? Murray, why is it $21.95 now?
So a lot of it comes back to, there's a few things. So the main one is, you know, our economy is so centered around the impact of fuel and the fuel price. So we use a lot of diesel, for example, to run tractors that are working in the fields, transporting people, working in the vineyards, moving equipment around. We're then using that as well to in trucks that are delivering wine to the harbor and all over the place. Beyond that, a lot of the agrochemicals are petroleum based or fossil fuel basis to them. You've then got another situation where we have the sort of the global shipping meltdown that we've seen, obviously during COVID, and then there were issues with the Suez Canal, and this, you know, it's been on and on and on. You know, the situations where there're not enough containers, or they're stuck in different ports, and so that's added to it because the cost of shipping's gone up. And then you also have a situation where, you know, this is just really infiltrating all the way through into every single product. So, for example, next year, our cardboard box suppliers, and a cardboard box, it's the last thing you think about with wine. It's something you transport the wine in and you recycle it when you finish with it. But, you know, those prices are going up 24% next year. And that's really a result of, you know, growing timber, processing it into boxes, and getting it out to us is expensive, uses a lot of fuel and energy, and there you go. So it's everything, all the inputs, you know, and with the cost of inflation, we need to pay our employees more. So that's an impact. So it's right throughout. We would have all seen it in the grocery store as well. And it's just an unfortunate, these knock on effects that have come about as a sort of perfect cocktail of, you know, shipping shortages, lockdowns in China, Ukraine conflict, the world opening up again. It's sort of this mishmash, and it's unfortunate because it's going to mean that we are going to have to pay more for wine, and either drink less and drink better, or just drink less, drink worse. You know, it's up to you. Yeah. Just drink the same amount, drink worse, or change your budget. I'm not sure. Everyone's going to have a strategy.
Yeah, well, as a professional uncle, it just means I have to spend more.
Right.
Actually, the one thing, the impact that has on your industry is South Africa is known for just the quality versus price point. And I've told everyone to do this. If you can't afford Napa Cab, don't worry. Go find South African Cabernet Sauvignon. It'll be half the price. Like when I go to like high-end restaurants where, you know, the markup, the first thing I do now, if I'm having a steak, I go look at the South African section, because I know I will, you know, the price point to value is better than a lot of mainstream California wines. But I guess this is going to have an impact on you guys, where you are always sort of this, hey, if you want a great bottle of wine and spend less money, go to South Africa. I guess now that's going to be impacted as well because of the inflation.
Sure. I think it's all relative. I mean, obviously the shipping is going to be cheap. It's cheaper to ship wine from California. It always has been, but you know, so the shipping rates are one consideration, but I think we're still going to be relatively inexpensive. You know, I think the whole wine category is going to shift up a price point, and we might get slightly more expensive and slightly less better value for money. But I think in the whole world of wine, we're still going to be phenomenal value for money.
Yes.
And we're still going to maintain that. And you can still buy, you know, incredible bottles of wine, you know, real handmade, you know, not factory made wine that from great estates for really good prices. And so, you know, the proof of the pudding's in the drinking, really, Matthew. People have got to, you know, taste for themselves and see what we're talking about, and see the look at the flavor profile of our wines. And I really feel like there's something for everybody in our wine styles.
Yeah, and when I say this is more just to promote South Africa and for the people listening to expand. It's not meant to actually rip on California, which it's a joke I make that if you're a Somm or you work in wine, at some point you need to rip on Napa Cab. And you have to profess your love for German Riesling. Those are the two things you need to do if you work in wine.
You know, I'm a great believer of give the people what they want. you know, and people must, you're the consumer, you're paying for the wine, you make the choice. If you want to put Coca-Cola in your wine, you want to put ice in your wine, you want to do whatever you want to do, you've purchased that bottle. If you want to pronounce that French chateau incorrectly, it's
go
your
ahead.
You pay for it. It's yours. Do
Hell yeah.
What you want to do. You have the power.
I agree with you on the mispronouncing. I remember once at a Christmas event, I brought a magnum of a good Montrachet, and a family member asked if they could put ice in it. And all I said, very politely, try it first without the ice. And if you still want the ice, we can put the ice into it. And you right. know what? They didn't ask for the ice.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, Murray, I want to hear about just about your journey. When did you realize that being in wine, that was going to be your profession?
So I grew up in a wine producing family. My family's owned and operated Rustenburg since 1941.
Yep.
My parents never put any pressure on me to join the business. You know, having grown up on the farm, it was always up to me what I wanted to do. And my brother, at about the age of 17, decided to go into journalism and media. I sort of sat there, and it was a bit of a focus time, sort of time for me to focus and think, oh, geez, okay, well, my brother's certainly not going to go into the wine business. There's this amazing brand and this amazing property. And I've always loved being on the farm. My brother was more, you know, he was reading books and I was driving on the back of tractors and getting dirty outside a little bit more. So that was something. And then, you know, I think what really galvanized me and really focused me was actually starting to drink wine. My father's always had an amazing cellar. And, you know, I think we had some amazing wines from the Rhone and Bordeaux that he'd aged. And they were just delicious and so easy to drink and just, you know, the complexity and everything was just so captivating that a natural product could be so amazing. And that's really where it started. So that was the love of it. I realized quite early on that I was going to battle, you know, most winemaking degrees are science degrees. So you're doing a lot of physics, chemistry, statistics, all sorts of subjects, which are not necessarily related to wine. Chemistry is very much related to wine, but not in an enormous level. It's really a finite amount of chemistry you need to know. So I worked out I could study winemaking without doing a science degree. All I needed to do was get an undergraduate, any undergraduate, and have first year undergraduate university chemistry. And I could study my master's in winemaking in Australia. So I went to Rhodes University in Grahamstown. Studied a human resources and labor relations degree. Which is very important. We employ a lot of people and I deal with a lot of people and in interaction with my business. And then when I finished that, I came home. I studied first year chemistry at the University of Stellenbosch. And then I went to the University of Adelaide in South Australia. I did a master's in coursework, which was 18 months. And it was just a fantastic time, you know, to immerse yourself in wine. We arrived in the middle of their winter and they'd frozen these enormous blocks, these 1,000-liter blocks of juice for us. And the first thing we did on the first day was defrost all this grape juice. And we started to make wine in the middle of winter. So within 18 months, we basically had two vintages at the cellar at the university. We had this amazing course we were on. The Australian Wine Research Institute was on the same campus. So we were exposed to some amazing new technologies. I met friends from all over the world. I still keep up those friendships. And then on the weekends, I was working in wineries to earn a bit of extra money and to be able to travel the wine regions of Australia and buy a great wine. And so it was just this wonderful, wonderful 18 months. When I finished, I came home and I had plans to sort of travel the world a bit and do vintages in different places and learn and see what's going on. Unfortunately, we uncovered a few sort of financial irregularities in the business and that sort of changed. Things changed quite quickly. So I went from going to travel the world to having to really jump into a wine business and fix it at the age, I think I was 23 or 4 at the time.
How much pressure was that? So at 23, 24, you had one life expectation. And now things change. How much? And it's family business. It's, you know, so
sure.
there's more of a connection. How much pressure was that at that age?
You know, I think it's, you know, people often talk about, you know, doing an MBA versus having the experience in running a business. I mean, I'm taking nothing away from an MBA. I think they are incredibly important. But having to fix a business from the ground up and getting to know every aspect of it, every division of it, and really getting to know the ins and outs, and taking it through the full value chain from, you know, the markets right through to the production and, you know, everything behind that. It was an incredible baptism of fire. It was quite tough. But today I've worked in every single division of the business. I know every single division of the business. You know, beyond overseeing the seller, I run all the financial side of everything. I know what down to the cent, what a bottle costs me, what a screw cap costs me, what a label costs me. So it adds another dimension to the wine world. You know, we often have this wonderful romantic sort of picture that's painted for us of wine, and how we, you know, we as winemakers, we have these long lunches and we drink a lot of wine at lunch and take people on tours and, you know, stride into the vineyards and taste the grapes. But it's a big business. You know, our factory's outside where the vineyards are, and we have these sort of babies and these children in the cellar maturing in our barrels that we have to look after. And but we've also got to make it pay, you know, because it, yeah. It's very big cash flow cycles. So each vintage, you've got to be making sure that you've got each year or each cycle, you've got to be making sure that your cash flow is right for the next vintage, and you can buy your fruits and pay your workers and buy the barrels and bottle the wine. And so it's an amazing business. I mean, you know, in any one day I could be speaking to someone in a vineyard about how they're going to work with a vine. In a few hours later, I could be tasting wine and making certain decisions on blending. In the afternoon, I'll be having a discussion about, you know, what a product costs. And then maybe in the afternoon, I could be speaking to someone like yourself and telling everyone the great story of the estate. So the diversity of hats you have to wear running a wine estate, it's just, it's great. And every day is a new day and there's no easy day, but it's an amazing, business to be in, really.
Yeah. And your brain is always being challenged with different things. It never gets stale. On one end, it's like any other business, like making widgets. Then there's the science, then there's the farming, then there's the romance, and then there's all the fear of just running and owning a business. By the way, it should be said, everyone listening, now that people are traveling, go to Rustenburg. I cannot stress enough. It's just absolutely gorgeous. You met so many things in that answer that I want to get to. I'm going to try to get to as many as I can. Blending. What... I'd love for if you could tell people just the process of blending, what goes in it, what you are looking for, when do you know you've got it right?
So with blending, you generally have an outcome which you're trying to achieve. So you're blending towards a style of wine. And you've obviously got the reality of the wines that you've made in front of you. So often what people think of with blending is blending more than one different grape variety. So Merlot with Cabernet, for example. But often, you know, we're dealing with multiple vineyards of, say, if we're making a single varietal wine, we'll have multiple vineyards of Cabernet Sauvignon. And we already have so many different variables to deal with. So each vineyard obviously is impacted by the weather. And some vineyards will do better in cool vintages and some better in warm vintages. All of the practices that we've put into that vineyard will impact the outcome of and the picking decision as well of how that wine looks. So we have a rough idea. We've worked with that vineyard up to the point of blending. We've made the wine. The wine's finished its alcoholic fermentation. It's gone through the malolactic fermentation where we've changed the acid of the wine or the acid profile of the wine. And then we start looking at it initially, and we're working towards style. So if you're trying to make a big, bold wine, you're then going to be selecting out those parcels. If you're wanting to make something light and fresh, you're also going to be working on that. So generally what we do with our blending is we start at the highest tier. So we'll do a selection of the best wines. And then from there, we'll work down depending on the ranges we produce. And you're really looking to stay within a style. You know, people have been drinking our wines for hundreds of years at Rustenburg. And we make changes. If we do make changes, they're incremental changes. So you don't suddenly want to go from sort of an enormously big alcohol fruity style wine. Not that we make those, but you don't want to go to that extreme and then swing across to something that's sort of lean and light and, you know, sort of delicate or whatever the case is. You make these changes quite slightly. So we'll always calibrate ourselves. We'll taste the wine. We'll taste within the style that we're aiming to blend towards. before we start, and then we sort of use that as a yardstick. Obviously, each vintage is different. But we do like to keep consistency, because that's why those wines are successful, and we try and work within that bound. So that, you know, the fact that you're using your sense of taste and smell as a business tool is also mind blowing. I mean, you know, it's just incredible. We're sitting there, we're smelling the wines. You can pick up a lot on the nose. You know, how fruity is the wine? Is there something wrong with the wine? Was the fermentation healthy? And then when you're tasting the wine, you're looking for, again, what's the acidity like? What are the tannins like? What's the body of the wine, the fruit in the wine? What's the flavor profile, the length of the flavor profile, the sort of the size in terms of its sort of roundness or its richness or its leanness of the flavor profile? So you're making a lot of judgment calls. We do blend as a team because we all have different strengths. I can pick up certain elements better than others. So for example, bitter characters in wine, I'm not very good at picking up on, but I can pick up a lot of faults in wine very well. So if there are any issues that happen during fermentation or if there's a spoilage problem, I can pick those up. So we work as a team. We blend as 4 to 5 trained winemakers, sometimes even 6 at a time, and we'll taste all the wines blind, and then we'll comment together and share our notes, and then we have a consensus in terms of where we're going with the wine. So it's a team effort.
That would be that, actually, for people that are in the business or people that want to learn about wine, just being able to sit on the sidelines as you guys are tasting and blending it, that would be really interesting. Do you have any specific moments in all your years where you felt so fantastic about a vintage, or then on the other end, a time when you're like, uh-oh, we're in trouble?
So I think great vintages are often vintages where you actually don't need to do very much. You know, the everything falls into place. The weather's great. The picking decisions are easy. The fruit's all perfectly ripe. Fermentation goes well. And, you know, those are the great years. You know, a year like 2015 comes to mind, or 2017 for us comes to mind, where, you know, if you made bad wine in those years, it's because, you know, you should probably stop making wine, because it was all the tough vintages are the ones where you are throwing some curveballs. You know, I'll probably the one that comes to mind most is in 2016, we had fires on the Simonsberg Mountain. So it's difficult to paint a picture for everyone listening to us, but when you visit us, you will see there are these beautiful mountains as a backdrop to the estate. We farm right on the foothills of this mountain. It's called the Simonsberg. And there is really a natural vegetation that grows throughout this area called fynbos. And for it to reproduce, it has to have fire. Seeds germinate as a result of being burnt. And so every 10 to 15 years, we do have fire on the mountain, and the mountain often burns completely. And in 2016, we had a particularly a tough fire that we were fighting. And, you know, Californian producers and those who following California will know that smoke taint is a problem. Yep. And we picked up a lot of smoke taint issues, and we had to, you know, declassify a lot of wine. And some of our best vineyards ended up being shipped off in a tanker and being turned into vinegar or being turned into a bag in the box or whatever the case is. So so really, that was a very tough time. You know, losing all that fruit. It was just before the harvest season, so it was right up close to the harvest. So that's the reality. As I said earlier, your factory is outside. We can't put shade cloth all over our vineyards or build them into buildings and control the atmosphere. It's a natural product that's grown outside, and it really tells the story of the weather and the climate that those vines were experienced or they were exposed to during that season. So you learn to be patient. You learn to just back up on your experience, but the experience of those who've done it before, and try not to do.
Setting it up, that must feel helpless. You've done all this work, pruning and everything you can, and then suddenly fire happens. And it's like, well, it's out of my hands now.
Well, you know, we fought the fires, so we only lost a relatively small amount of vineyard to being burned.
Good.
But the smoke that was hanging around was really quite intense.
Yeah.
And hung around for days and days and days, and it was absorbed by the fruit, and there was ash on the fruit, and there were all sorts of issues. And it's, you just do the best you can. You just do the best you can. There's nothing more to it. You know, in other situations, you'll have really tough, dry heat waves or drought conditions. Again, you can only do so much. You can only irrigate so much. You can only do so much, or in other vintages, it's raining and, you know, you can't put an umbrella over every single vine. So same story, you've got to be pragmatic and make the decisions at the time that you've got obviously the logistics of how much you can pick and when you can pick. And you've got the reality of whether the fruit is ripe or whether you're making the right call. So it's an amazing product. I think, you know, if people start delving into wine, it's certainly not like making Coca-Cola or beer. There's no recipe really. We have an idea of what we want to do. We have a style that we're aiming for, but every year gives us this brand new set of challenges. And that's why you see a vintage on the bottles, because every vintage tells a story and that's the beauty of it.
It is. It is one of the coolest things about wine, and what makes it different than any other product is that, every year tells a story of weather, of humanity, of science, and everything in between. In case I forget, tell people just a little bit about your portfolio in terms of the wines that are out there, the wines that, just your whites and your red program.
Sure. So we, in the white program, our big focus is on Chardonnay. So we produce three different Chardonnays. We produce an unwooded style, we produce a barrel fermented style, and then we have a single vineyard barrel fermented style. So Chardonnay is probably our strongest suit in terms of whites. We like to use natural yeast, so everything is fermented wild. There's no yeast that we add, so we have this wonderful complexity from all the different wild yeasts fermenting the Chardonnays. And we do like to work with oak. Obviously, we want oak to be integrated into the wines and part of the wines, and to really improve them and not be sort of something that people don't enjoy. So we've spent a lot of time choosing the right coopers and the right selections, and Chardonnay really is one of our strongest suits. And then beyond that, we do a fantastic Sauvignon Blanc. So Sauvignon, where we are in Stellenbosch, is people often consider too warm for Sauvignon, but we plant Sauvignon right high up on the mountainside. So we're a good 300 meters, 900 feet higher than the rest of our vineyards where we plant Sauvignon. And as you know, if you look at some of the coolest places in the world, like New Zealand, they produce great Sauvignon there. So Sauvignon needs a cool climate to give you that fantastic acidity, but also the fruit development of a slow ripening process. So great Sauvignon coming on from us. And then we also work with a bit of Chenin and a little bit of other quirky varieties. We have small vineyards of Roussan and a little bit of Grenache Blanc, for example. But these are really just for interest. They're the kind of wines you can taste at our cellar door. Yeah. And then on the reds, Bordeaux style reds are our big focus. So we've focused over the last few years on those. Cabernet Sauvignon principally. And then we blend with Merlot, and Merlot goes into a few of our blends with Cabernet. And then Malbec is a varietal that's doing fantastically well. We're seeing Malbec do very, very well in the Stellenbosch region. We're focusing on Malbec as well. And then we have a small vineyard of Petit Verdot, and then small little amounts of Syrah and Grenache, although these are diminishing and we are reducing those plantings to focus more on the Bordeaux varietal. So principally Chardonnay and Cabernet and Cabernet-based blends, quite international, but really that's what we've been grown to be known for. And I think that's the reason why we export so much of our wine, because we are producing internationally relevant wines and styles that people are enjoying.
And we have got like six more minutes. Stupid Zoom. I got to upgrade it. It says, you got 40 minutes. All right. I want to go back. We'll circle back to this. How important is it? Because you spent that time in Australia. How important is it for a winemaker to make wines, to work on vintages in other parts of the world?
It's very important, because you're going to be exposed to lots of different people's winemaking styles, their ethos, different climatic conditions. It's not just about working in different regions. It's also about working in different sizes of wineries. You know, a small winery crushing 20 to 50 tons of grapes, you'll have a very different experience to one crushing 50,000 tons of grapes. So that's also important to see, because as big as those sort of very corporate sort of factory wineries are, there's still a lot of good things happening there in terms of, you know, their protocols and how they keep things clean, and, you know, how they manage the workflow and their accountability, et cetera. And then in the small winery side, you see, you know, people who are absolutely dedicated to every single grape and how it's treated and how it's going to impact the wines. So that's important. And you're going to see a lot of different things and how people react. And at the same time, there's the fun part of it. You're going to, you know, taste the food and visit the vineyards and drink the wines and maybe go and visit the beaches. And some, you know, a lot of winemakers love surfing. So that's a great thing to experience. So it's also, you know, wherever wine is made, there's always, you know, good food is not far behind.
Yes.
As well. But there's great gastronomy to enjoy. And people, you know, we're one big family really. There's no real secrets in winemaking. If anyone tells you there's a secret to how their wine's made, they're having you on, because there's only a finite number of things we can do, and the rest is really the vineyards doing the talking. So it's good to learn that and to understand that. So it's a magical thing to do, to travel and to make wine.
God, it's my favorite thing as well. That's why visiting you guys, visiting in Germany just a little while ago, and New Zealand. And anyway, last question for you. I was reading in one of your interviews, you say we want to create classic wines that speak about where they're made and are varietally correct and stylistically true. So it's a hard question to answer, but for you, we'll go the Rustenburg, your Bordeaux blends. What for you defines the classic version of your Rustenburg reds?
Well, yeah, for the Bordeaux blends, I mean, we are not, if you look at, say, the structure of the classic structure in Bordeaux, you've got the left bank, which is Cabernet dominated, and the right bank, which is Merlot dominated. So we're not married to that belief that we've got to use a blend that's X percent of Cabernet and a Y percent of Merlot and Z percent of Petit Verdot or whatever the case is. So we blend the best wine we can from the vintage. Some years the Merlot shows better, some years the Cabernet shows better. Some years we use a small percentage of Petit Verdot, some years we use a large percentage. So it all really depends. So for me, it's about saying whatever wine is in front of the consumer, whatever wine we're planning to bottle is the best from that vintage. It's going to change, but it really is the best we can put forward. And some years we'll have more fruit, some years we'll be a little bit more structured. But it's about capturing that essence of the vintage, that trueness of the vintage, obviously within a style, and expressing that in the wines. And I think that's the nice thing about following us, is that you will see a golden thread running through our wines, but you will also see this change in the vintages, which is the magic of it. You know, I think some very commercial wines, they try and sort of beat out the individuality of the vintage, and they try and have this very sort of carbon copy process to making wine or blending, putting wines together to bottle. And that's just not fun. Because the vintage tells a wonderful story, and that's what we're trying to express.
And it certainly gives you, more flexibility and more sort of artistic expression to really explain what these wines are. Murray, I really appreciate it. I tell everyone, it depends where people are listening. If you're in Canada, Ontario, wherever, go out to the LCBO or your local wine store, find the wines of South Africa, find the Cabernets, go find the Rustenburgs. I've tried, you know, most of the profile, and I'm not just saying this because if I didn't believe it, I wouldn't be interviewing Murray. They all consistently punch well above their weight. It's one of the things I've learned over the last year in terms of my exposure with the reds and the whites, with the reds of South Africa, and specifically Stellenbosch. So Murray, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast here today.
Matthew, thank you. Thanks for coming to see us, because I really believe you have a great overview of what we're about, actually coming and seeing us. And anyone visiting a wine region, it suddenly makes sense, and you have this wonderful experience of reliving that visit every time you drink the wines from that area or from that producer. So great to have you visit us. And anyone who's sick and tired of your Canadian winter, remember we're having amazing warm weather in South Africa. So jump on an airplane. It is a long flight, but you can come and spend the day on the beach on Christmas Day with us.
Yes.
So we have a wonderful country to visit from a touristic point of view. We have it's fantastic value for money. I think one Canadian dollar nearly buys you 14 rand. So
it's crazy. It's crazy. You will live like a king with a Canadian money.
You're going to be paying sort of two, three star prices for 4 or 5 star experiences, and there's lots to enjoy. So you know, beyond that, I'd say, you know, seek our wines out. South Africa's really focusing on growing our distribution in Canada. We work a lot with the LCBO. We regularly release wines and vintages every few months. There's also some of our wines coming out in the classic selection. Quebec, we've got amazing presence. We're in the Maritimes, we're in Alberta, we're in BC. So seek us out. I love visiting Canada, and it's one of my favorite places to work, and you're great supporters of our wine. So thank you, and hope to see you soon when I'm next in Canada.
Love it. Would love to. And again, fly to Cape Town, quick drive to Stellenbosch, beautiful place to spend time. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.